Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
I'm a terribly frightened flyer. I usually take medication, and I pray a lot.
Traveler, beware. It's a wild, dangerous world out there. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm currently summering in my cubicle. My vacation a few weeks back already seems like a really long time ago. So what does summer mean when you're spending your days at the office? It means for me, I'm watching my toes turn blue in my sandals because the AC is so cold. And every time I get excited because I received a really quick reply to an email, it's just one of those, I'm out of the office with very limited access to the internet. And sure, I get it. This is a great time to be out there on the road exploring the world. So we decided to make today's show about travel. Maybe that's not the most original idea ever, but here's the twist. We're not looking to make you green with envy by taking you to some amazing dream destinations. Oh no, we're going to look at this topic in a very pulsy way, digging into the science behind the many perils and mishaps involved in traveling. Trust me, it's going to be a blast. Or, to use the immortal words of Clark W. Griswold,
well, I'll tell you something, this is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
The quest will take us to Hungary for some dental work, we'll hop onto a plane and hit some heavy turbulence, and we'll check in with people who say staying home is the real vacation. Here to start us off on the first leg of our journey is our reporter, Alana Gordon. Hi, Alana.
Hey, Megan.
So I said travel, and you said...
puking.
That doesn't surprise me too much. Why?
Well, besides that not surprising you too much, when you think about driving or being in a car, being on a plane, traveling, lots of us get motion sick, get car sick, and might toss our cookies, basically. And so it turns out that there's some mystery to this, even though it seems like a common, simple thing that happens. So I've talked to a lot of people who can relate to this motion sickness kind of scenario, people like Lori Mazur and her 2-year-old daughter, Anya. They don't really look forward to these summer car rides.
So when you ride in the car, what happens sometimes, Anya?
I throw up.
Mm-hmm.
During a 5-hour trip about a month ago, Mikan, Anya's older brother, Diarmid, recalls how she puked twice within the first 10 minutes of hitting the road.
Oh, yeah, she threw up on the bridge the first time.
Where did you throw up?
In my car seat and on my blankie.
Oh, so what did they do?
Well, thankfully, traffic was light, so they pulled over, cleaned up, but...
On the drive home, you threw up again, right, in Connecticut?
Uh-huh.
It was all made up of fruit, right?
Fruit.
So it was bright pink because it had lots of blueberries in it.
Alana.
You're welcome.
So what did you find out about why this happens?
It's pretty interesting because actually what exactly causes people to get car sick has been the subject of some debate. And actually there's a prevailing theory, which is that
when people are getting either too much motion or else they're getting motion that conflicts with another sense that's telling them how fast they're moving.
This is Dr. Timothy Hain. He's a neurologist in Chicago who specializes in dizziness and balance. He says most people, when put through enough motion,
such as in life rafts and rough seas, will vomit.
Yep, they'll puke. But he says the main thing that makes some of us puke is when there's a conflict between movement and one of our senses. So like when you're in the backseat of a car looking at your cell phone, he says your inner ear, this is the part of your body that helps regulate balance, is registering that you're moving.
Which is telling you that you're bouncing up and down in the car.
But your eyes, which are in the car, maybe locked on that cell phone, send signals that everything is still.
So there's a sensory conflict between the eye and the ear.
Expectations don't match, making you nauseous. Another example, way, way above the car.
At the present time, the astral van has passed the...
is in outer space.
Center, and is now close to the checkpoint.
Lots of astronauts get sick. Even the best of them, like Chris Hadfield.
When we first get to space, we feel sick. Your body's really confused.
These people who are so great on the ground and very great with flying jet airplanes, when they're up in outer space, they have a new sensory situation in that the parts of their ear that sense gravity are now totally irrelevant because there's no longer any gravity to sense.
They can't tell which way is down.
So this causes a horrible sensory conflict.
So let's say you're about to throw up in space. Quick, you get your barf bag open.
But coming back down to all of us on Earth, who gets sick varies. We do know that people whose inner ear is totally damaged are immune to motion sickness. Then again, kids and women appear to be more prone to it. Same for people who get migraines. But this is where things get complicated, because there's a lot at play. Externally, you have differing movements and stimulus, and then internally, there's variation in how your muscles react, how your brain and that inner ear adjusts to what's going on. So all of this means it's been hard for scientists to parse out any single cause or combination. And they have been studying it in real life, in virtual reality labs. NASA even has what's come to be known as the Vomit Comet to research this. These are planes that can create weightless environments. This layer of mystery means scientists really don't know why some people recover more rapidly than others, and why some people never adjust. Tom Stoffregen is another scientist who's been trying to figure this out.
Yeah, but we move all the time and we don't feel sick. The $64,000 question is, what causes it?
He's a professor of kinesiology at the University of Minnesota.
Why would a conflict between what you expect and what you experience make you feel nauseous? Nobody really has the slightest idea why the symptoms are what they are.
Stoffregen doesn't buy the widely accepted sensory conflict theory when your senses and what's going on don't match up. He's in the minority, but he thinks the main factor has to do with physical movement. He's interested in the differences in the subtle ways our bodies sway when we're still and in control versus when we're thrown around on a bumpy bus. Or
You get on a ship, the ship moves around in ways that you cannot control or predict, okay? And you're walking around, you're doing whatever you're doing. So your foot is going to hit the deck in ways that you didn't expect.
He thinks on board, the body loses its ability to maintain its natural posture and then struggles to compensate. Why that leads to barfing still stumps him. But either way, Mikan, if all of this is starting to make you a little dizzy, Stoffregen and others do agree there are some things people can do to avoid getting sick.
Such as?
Well, first, get behind the wheel.
The best way to prevent getting car sick is to drive. No, seriously.
The driver doesn't seem to get sick. Same goes for pilots. He thinks that's because the driver is in control. He or she can anticipate what's coming and more easily stabilize the body.
But thinking about the little girl, the fruit-puking little girl, how is that going to help her?
I know, that advice really won't help little two-year-old Anya. Or let's say you're a passenger on a bus.
Being in the front seat is better than being in the back seat. And the big thing that anybody of any age can do is keep your gaze outside the car.
So focus on objects that are far away. And then getting back on that ship, Stoffregen reminds us of this centuries-old technique.
For thousands of years, mariners have said to novice passengers, if you're worried about feeling sick or if you begin to feel a little bit woozy, go up on deck and look at the horizon.
But whatever you do, he and others say, don't read. And don't even think about looking at electronics. Perhaps another reason to think twice about opening up that Pokemon Go? All of this is encouraging advice for Anya's mom.
What is she going to do?
Well, she has an anti-puke plan for their next trip.
We probably play a lot more I Spy with Anya to get her focused. And she's not doing screens anymore in the back seat, which is, as anyone knows, traveling with kids for 5 hours, probably a curse for all of us.
It sure is. I play a lot of I Spy, and it is wildly entertaining, as you can imagine.
Woo!
Thank you, Alana.
But wait, one more thing?
Sure.
So, being sick on the road can be kind of traumatic at the time, but lots of people had stories that they were really eager to share, so I thought we'd take a listen.
Go for it.
Just so you know, I didn't actually throw up. My name is Brian Thompson. I live in Salina, Kansas. I grew up in a little town called Buckland, Kansas, in the southwestern part of the state. When I was, 5 or 6 years old, we'd get in the car, drive for half an hour or so, and I'd say, Dad, pull over! And then I'd get out and, bend over and kind of heave a few times, and nothing would come out. finally, after this went on for a while, they took me to the doctor, and the doctor started examining me, and all of a sudden he says, "Get him in the car and get him up to the hospital." In a matter of minutes, I was being prepped for an appendectomy. I never really had much problem with car sickness after that.
My name is Kyle Kavecki. I'm calling from Boston. I went on a flight with my family from Boston to California and had a smoothie in the airport. It was delicious. And on the flight, just ended up, I think it was probably 3 bags worth, just puking and losing everything that was within my stomach.
I'm Malia Brooker. I'm calling from Miami, Florida, and I grew up in rural southern Indiana. I have a memory as a kid of thinking that I was nauseous, that I had, you know, stomach problems because of All Things Considered. We listened to it in the car, you know, when that theme song came on. You know, my stomach would cramp up. I would feel like something was wrong. I would try to tell my parents to turn it off. It's making me sick. But, of course, it was not All Things Considered. It was the 30-minute windy drive through rural Indiana to our home.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. I'm usually fine in cars, but I do get sick on boats, and I get very sick on planes. And I always wonder why the barf bags they provide are so tiny. It doesn't make any sense. But anyway, every time I've gotten sick on a plane, it was due to turbulence. Our science reporter, Irina Zhorov, hates turbulence as well, even though for slightly different reasons. But she bravely stepped on a plane anyway to find out what actually causes these bumps. So here she goes.
Confession. I am an anxious flyer. It hasn't stopped me from flying, but I walk down the jet bridge as if down a plank, doomed to think dark thoughts until the plane lands. On a recent flight from San Francisco to Philadelphia, I turned to my fellow passengers at the gate for fretful solidarity. This strategy initially backfired.
I like turbulence. It's kind of like fun, kind of like a roller coaster.
I'm pretty comfortable flying.
It always passes, right?
That's Josie Cole, Court Winkle, and Jen Winkle, some of my braver fellow passengers. Then, desperate to find an empathetic ear, I approached Catherine Winterly. I knew she was my people by the timid gaze she cast toward the gate.
I'm a terribly frightened flyer. I usually take medication, and I pray a lot.
She's driven long distances to avoid flights and taken trains.
I just freak out. I mean, fortunately, I've not been in one of those planes where it's so bad that people are harmed, and I'm convinced that if I were, I'd be murdered because I would carry on so badly. Oh, I'd be screaming, "We're going down, we're going to die," you know? I mean, I know that's what I would do.
In no hurry to get on the plane, Catherine and I were some of the last people to board. I found my seat and buckled up.
Keep your seatbelt fastened when the seatbelt sign is on. And just in case there's turbulence, keep it on whenever you are in your seat.
As we took off, a man several rows down reached his hand across the aisle to comfort his companion, who was clutching her armrest. I turned to my seatmate, 12-year-old Daniel Kim.
We're going to Philadelphia for a family reunion.
It was Kim's second time flying. He was 3 the first time. He said he's never really felt turbulence, but he wasn't looking forward to it.
I already know that I'd be pretty scared if that happened.
How come if you've never experienced it?
I am. No idea, but I know I'd be scared.
It really amazed me when I started covering air travel and fielding questions from the flying public just how many people are put off and made anxious by rough air. It's far and away the number one concern of anxious flyers and even just regular flyers.
That's Patrick Smith. He's a commercial airline pilot and writes the blog AskThePilot.com. It surprised him because in the cockpit, turbulence is normal, more annoyance than concern, and pretty hands-off.
When the air gets rough, you're not fighting the forces. You're not turning left as the plane wants to go right and kind of battling with the turbulence. You're more or less just riding it out.
While I am, wrongly, I admit, thinking about the wings or tail falling off and the plane spinning out of the sky like an injured bird, Smith is apparently thinking about other stuff.
If I had a dollar for every time at the conclusion of a flight, a passenger said, boy, that was pretty bumpy, and me and the other pilot will look at each other and just not have any recollection of it being bumpy at all.
In an effort to educate myself past the fear, I phoned Roger Connor. He's an aeronautics curator at the National Air and Space Museum. He also has his pilot's license. I wanted to know what turbulence is.
A lot of turbulence comes about because of the same thing that causes all weather, which is the differential heating of the Earth's surface by the sun.
The sun heats the Earth's surface, which in turn warms the air sitting above it, causing it to rise. But things absorb and reflect heat at different rates. And so air, depending on whether it's sitting over hot pavement or a cooler grassy field, will float up at different speeds. The streams of chaotically moving air bump up against each other and cause a plane flying through them to wobble. Features on the ground, like hills, can force air up and create turbulence too. Think of it as a river, where the current changes depending on whether the water courses over a smooth bottom or over large boulders or hits the bank. If you're in a canoe, the uneven currents can jostle you, just like uneven air shakes up a plane. This kind of turbulence is common low to the ground, and because planes flew below 10,000 feet in the early days of commercial flight in the 1930s, passengers experienced it often and fully.
People would start getting sick, and then it would just kind of move up the cabin, so that could be very unpleasant.
Unpleasant is a bit of an understatement if we believe what a pilot named Ernest Gann wrote about flying in the 1930s in his memoir. He wrote, quote, "The winds are stagnant and sullen, yet the air is annoyingly potted with a multitude of minor vertical disturbances which sicken the passengers. The airplanes smell of hot oil and simmering aluminum, disinfectant, feces, leather, and puke. The stewardesses, short-tempered and reeking of vomit, come forward as often as they can for what is a breath of comparatively fresh air." Connor says the air sickness bag, now mostly a novelty, was well used back then.
After World War II, you're still flying propeller-driven aircraft for a decade or so, but you have pressurized cabins as well as turbo superchargers that allow the aircraft to get up higher.
By the mid-1950s, jet aircrafts are coming online.
Which, of course, means that we can really get into the stratosphere, which really gets you out of that lower level zone of turbulence in the troposphere. And that does a huge amount to improve the quality of flights.
Also, turbulence prediction has improved. Onboard and grounded radars, whilst constant updates from other planes, all help pilots see where turbulence might happen and how to avoid it. Though flights have become smoother, turbulence hasn't disappeared. At higher altitudes, tall mountain ranges can lift up large air masses, which interact with other airstreams, causing turbulence hundreds of miles downwind. Thunderstorms cause turbulence. And then there's clear air turbulence. It's caused by jet streams, fast-moving rivers of wind that loop around the globe, interacting with slower-moving air. It's invisible and hard to forecast. According to the National Transportation Safety Board, from 2010 to 2015, turbulence played a role in injuring 174 people and killing 42 on domestic flights. The majority of fatalities were on personal or small planes. But generally, what comforts we've lost as plane cabins went from well-appointed living rooms to sardine cans with seatbelts, we gained in the quality of the ride itself. Though I kept my mic poised for disaster, my flight to Philadelphia proceeded uneventfully, even smoothly. I checked in with Daniel Kim before we touched down to see how it went for him.
It was great. Aside from a little bit of, like, turbulence at the end and the middle, it was okay.
The turbulence didn't scare you, though, like you thought it would?
Yeah, but once I witnessed it, I guess it wasn't too bad. I mean, it wasn't that severe. And my next flight home, I bet, yeah, it's probably going to be okay as well.
That's right. It's probably going to be okay. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Is flying more fun when you're the one actually flying the plane rather than biting your nails every time you hit a bump? Pilots sure seem to love their jobs, so much so that some of them volunteer to fly some more in their free time. Check out our story on Angel Flight East. It's a coalition of pilots who fly medical patients from where they live to where they need to go for treatment. Our website is whyy.org/thepulse. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're hopping on a plane this summer to go on vacation, chances are you're going to be annoyed about super tight seating and carry-on luggage restrictions. Or if you're on an international flight, you will regret having chosen the chicken and not the pasta. The pasta always looks much better. But will you spend hours feeling guilty about what your flight means for the Earth, for climate change? Probably not, right? James Higham is a professor of tourism at the University of Otago in New Zealand, and he's interested in something called the flyer's dilemma. It's the tension between our desire to travel by plane and the impact we all know aviation fuel has on climate change. For his research, he interviews people all over Europe on their attitudes about flying.
So the first country in Europe that we studied was Norway, and we did so because the Norwegian government in recent years has been quite outspoken about carbon neutrality. So we thought that Norway may be a bit of an indicator market in terms of how people think about their aviation emissions. And what we found in Norway was really fascinating, because we spoke to a lot of people in Norway who travel a lot. Travel a lot by air. And what we found in Norway was people are really concerned about climate change, and they are experiencing it in their daily lives. So, for example, some explained that they had seen climate change in action because places where they used to ski when they were kids are now unskiable because they never have snow anymore. So Norwegians were really concerned about climate change. But they were also quite addicted to air travel and found it very, very difficult to sacrifice the freedoms of air travel to the extent that very few were actually changing their behaviors or taking any direct action.
A lot of the traveling we do is not for business. It's for fun. It's to go on vacation, to visit friends. Have you found that people feel differently about that kind of travel as opposed to going on a business trip?
Most people, when it comes to climate change, if they're concerned about climate change, are finding ways to try and resolve feelings of guilt, feelings of responsibility in their day-to-day lives. So they may explain their efforts by way of reducing energy consumption in their households, insulating their houses, installing solar panels on their roofs, and these sorts of domestic activities. But one of the real challenges with aviation emissions, and particularly leisure air travel emissions, is that when people go on holiday, they largely do so to get away from the problems in their lives. The holidays are an escape. So even people who are extremely well-educated and knowledgeable about climate change and understand the threats of climate change and agree that we need to respond to the climate challenge, when they go on holidays, they forget about those concerns and they tend to book a flight and travel without any guilty sentiments at all.
But there might be a sense, look, this plane is going to fly whether I'm on it or not, so I might as well hop on board.
Absolutely. And that sentiment has been expressed quite regularly in our research program. One of the challenges that we face is that in terms of mitigating aviation emissions, airplanes have become more and more efficient in the jet age. Since the 60s, there have actually been very impressive efficiency gains in jet aviation. And so technical and operational gains have served an important purpose here. But the problem is, getting back to your question, that aviation has grown phenomenally over the last four decades, since the 1970s, and is forecast to grow incredibly over the coming 30 to 50 years. So relatively modest efficiency gains are being absolutely overwhelmed by the fact that the global fleet of commercial passenger aircraft has doubled every 20 years since the 1970s and is projected to double again over the next 20 years. The reality is that we have to limit growth in aviation, and aviation emissions, climate change concerns, require that we fly less.
So are there any solutions coming our way, or do we have to potentially give up flying if we really want to be environmentally sound in all of our decisions?
I don't think I can foresee a future when no one flies, but I think that people are going to have to accommodate their flying behaviours in their broader carbon budgets. So we are going to have to think more carefully about this. It's interesting that you talk about the future, because the Climate Paris Accord has been seen as a great success in recent months, but aviation and maritime transport emissions were excluded from the Paris Climate Accord. But there is a conference coming up. The International Civil Aviation Organization is meeting in Montreal in September this year to respond to Paris and try and hammer out a solution to address aviation emissions. So we will watch Montreal and the International Civil Aviation Organization in September with great interest.
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
James Higham is a professor of tourism at the University of Otago in New Zealand. So to avoid the flyer's dilemma, maybe we ought to get on a boat to escape to some dream destination. Not so fast. Terrible dangers await there as well.
We found something on board several cruise ships you are not paying for.
New developments tonight in the norovirus outbreak in Asheville.
More than 200 people are sick with the norovirus this morning after outbreaks on two different cruise ships.
Here's reporter Paul Rayburn with more.
Every time Sinem Lula hears about a norovirus outbreak, she feels a little bit queasy, because it reminds her of one of the worst weeks of her life.
I've never been hit by anything that bad.
Lula is a real estate agent in New York, and she went on a Caribbean cruise with her husband and sons, who were 5 and 3 at the time.
They were absolutely thrilled. We had done a cruise a year back with their grandparents, and they had really, really enjoyed that. So they had been asking, especially the 5-year-old, he had been asking that we should go on a cruise again. So they were actually very excited.
Everything was great until day 2 of their trip, when Lula noticed during dinner that something was off.
I ate the appetizer, and I wasn't feeling very good after that, and I couldn't eat the rest of my dinner. Went back to the room, and I was very sick. I had projectile vomiting, my stomach was hurting, I had diarrhea. The whole night, it was me, the bed, and the bathroom.
The next day, she couldn't get out of bed. This went on for 2 days. Then her 5-year-old son got sick. And when he was better, her youngest son got the virus. He was still sick when the cruise ended. They most likely had norovirus, the most common and notorious offender among stomach bugs. The virus looks like a tiny ball with a feathery surface, a little bit like a Christmas tree ornament, and cruise ships with their close quarters are a perfect environment for this offender.
If you get infected with norovirus, it came from another person at some point.
Epidemiologist Aaron Hall tracks noroviruses at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Now, whether you got it directly through direct contact with that person, or that person's fecal matter ends up in your food or in your water or left on a surface that you then go and touch and then put your hands in your mouth.
There are about 20 million cases each year in the U.S., and those infections lead to about 700,000 hospitalizations and more than 800 deaths, mostly in young children and those over 65.
Anybody who has been infected by a norovirus and has gotten sick from it will tell you there is nothing good about it.
That's Ken Cadwell, a microbiologist at New York University School of Medicine, who studies stomach bugs and their interactions with the immune system. and he is investigating some redeeming qualities of this awful virus.
We've recently found that a mouse norovirus can be beneficial and act as part of this intestinal environment and serve a role that's similar to bacterial members of the microbiome. And so a big question for us is, how is the norovirus functioning this way and how can it be beneficial? Is it different from the way that bacteria are beneficial?
Cadwell is trying to figure out when the norovirus is a benign actor and what turns it into a hostile agent. And as for the awful vomiting and diarrhea that comes with this virus, Cadwell says nobody knows why that happens. It could be that the body is trying to clear out the virus, a defensive reaction, but the mechanism is not yet understood. And you can catch this virus over and over again, because, just like flu, there are many types. For The Pulse, I'm Paul Rayburn.
Speaking of norovirus, the Republican National Convention was just struck by an outbreak. But for people traveling for the sake of politics, that's just one of the many health risks they face. Think about it. They go from one place to the next. They rush around all the time. They work endless hours, eat terrible food, sleep really little. So we were wondering, what kind of toll does that take on your health over time? Ken Snyder spent years managing campaigns ranging from U.S. Senate to gubernatorial races to big city mayoral races, and he told us about his experiences.
You go to sleep late, right, and you wake up early. Usually, you don't wake up as much as come to with a pang of stress around 4:30 in the morning or 5 in the morning. Oh, the data is coming in. I wonder if it's in my inbox. We have a press event we have to set up in 3 hours. What's that, my quote, going to look like in the paper? Did we get the story we wanted? Usually you go to sleep only because you're exhausted and you can't stay up. And then you sort of wake up only because you've been jolted awake by a moment of consciousness when you realize that, oh my God, there's a whole nother day ahead of me here. So you almost think of these campaigns as a deployment. When you're managing a political race, it's almost as if you've been deployed and you're away from your family. And even when you're home, you're on your laptop and you're on your phone, and you never really shut it down. And even when you're not on your laptop and not on your phone, you're sort of laying awake, sort of staring at the ceiling, thinking about how to do things the next day or how we should have done them the day before. I'm a stress eater, and I used to be a stress smoker back in the 90s when I was working on campaigns, and I had all these little triggers, like when a reporter would call, I'd light up, and that would happen all day long, especially when you're the press secretary on a campaign. So you find yourself chain smoking, when I stopped smoking, I was constantly like eating junk, just candy, and not even noticing it. I tend to pace around when I'm on the phone and sort of just dig into stuff. And if there was a bowl of carrots, I suspect I would have eaten carrots, but there never is. I remember in 1998, I was managing a governor's race, and one of the campaign workers, we didn't have cell phones, cameras on our cell phones back then, but I remember one of our campaign workers stood on my chair and shot down on my desk, and there were like 15 empty coffee cups with cigarette butts in them and empty wrappers and potato chip bags, and it sort of all accumulates on you before you realize it. And I remember I was managing a mayor's race in 2011 and ignored a little cough for days and days and days, and eventually it turned into a bigger cough to the point where every time I tried to breathe, it felt like I had I was getting hit in the chest with a baseball bat, but I just didn't have time to deal with it. And even the thought of going to the doctor and taking a morning off was stressful in and of itself. Ultimately, I went just to get some antibiotics or something, and it turned out I had pneumonia. Which I'm sure I spread like a carrier monkey to everyone else. I don't know who Typhoid Mary was in that one. When one person gets sick, and they power through it, which is, by the way, expected, and sort of just acknowledged that that's part of the gig. The whole campaign at that point turns into a petri dish, right? It's 3,000 square feet of illness. At the end of 2011, that campaign where I got pneumonia, I'm a 5'7". I should weigh about 165. At the end of that campaign, I was over 200 pounds. Just technically, I mean, in every way obese, right? And I've just decided after that campaign that I was going to be a little more health conscious. After decades of sort of gaining a lot of weight in the worst possible ways and then losing a lot of weight, it's just a lot of stress on my body. I'm 50 now, but I joke that if you cut me open, I'm probably 80 on the inside. Treat your body like you do your candidate, right? Make time for it. Care about it. Don't ignore it. At the end of a campaign, it's like going off the edge of a table. Imagine thousands and thousands of stimuli just pounding your brain, and all of a sudden you wake up on Wednesday morning and it's over, and you hit the beach.
Ken Snyder is one of the founders of Snyder Pickerel Media Group in Chicago. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about travel, and let me ask you a question. Let's say your dentist charges about $3,000 for a bridge. How far would you travel to pay much, much less for that same dental work? That's the kind of question journalist Sasha Eisenberg answers in his new book, Outpatients, The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. In this book, he describes, for example, how Hungarian dentists began marketing their services to Austrians in the late 90s. Take a short trip, save thousands on dental work, that kind of thing. And Eisenberg talks about how these efforts bloomed under the leadership of a celebrity dentist called Béla Bartófy. So I asked him to tell me more about this guy.
Yeah, he got very lucky. One of his patients in the early 90s was a guy named Viktor Orban, who now, 20 years later, is the prime minister of Hungary. And so Bartófy had grown his business with English patients who were flying in from London. He eventually opened a clinic in London, would go once a month to do screenings and to do some aftercare for patients who came for surgery to Budapest. And he became incredibly wealthy with this practice. And what Bartófy has been able to do is basically make dental tourism part of Hungary's national economic agenda. And so the government has given him, or a group that he helps to direct, a significant amount of money to promote Hungarian dentistry. I quoted one of his advisors saying, we hope that it becomes that in Belgium you get chocolates, and in Switzerland you get watches, and in Hungary you get dentistry.
And if I were to go to Hungary for, let's say, an implant, something that is exceedingly expensive in this country, what could I expect to pay?
I think the sort of ballpark would be in the 30-40% range for the procedure itself. You know, what people in the medical tourism sector say is that if you can keep the price, the total cost, this is now we're talking about involving travel and maybe paying a facilitator, which is basically a travel agent who specializes in medical tourism, to 50% of what people would pay at home, that they become willing to travel. The kind of rule of thumb is once you get a lot more than that, people might not be willing to take
I'm thinking
the risk
about it already.
Yes. And part of what has made Budapest appealing is that it's become possible to sort of package in conventional tourism. And so, you know, if somebody's going with a spouse or a family member and they're going to have to show up a day before their surgery and then have several days of rest, you know, you end up talking about a week before they're traveling again. And so choosing some place that's intrinsically desirable where the other members of the family can, you know, go to the Hungarian baths and visit the museum and see the palace.
So you're combining pleasure and being a patient.
Yeah, you know, the other way that folks do this is you see a huge growth of Thailand as a destination for all sorts of medical tourism procedures. And part of the appeal there is, you know, you're recuperating, you know, why not do it on a beach? But there's a big search for sort of comparative advantage as a lot of countries develop comparable specialties. There's a lot of marketing that goes into a general notion that this will be make a miserable experience as pleasant as possible.
What does it take to ease patients' fears if you are in a position as a patient where you are making a choice based on cost and the service you will receive? There's still an element of fear. Will I get good care? And what happens if I don't?
Yeah, and some of that risk is never going to go away. So a lot of it is, bedside manner that translates well across cultures and borders, and knowing that they don't have the safety net that comes along with. I mean, you go to a dentist for whatever in your home county, and if it doesn't go well, you know that there's a court system and that there's a government body that you're sort of familiar with that is certified or licensed this person. And you go to a different country and that system may not exist, or you may not understand how it works. And you certainly won't know that often until you're back home and you have some problem.
Where do you see this industry going? Do you see it becoming bigger?
Yeah, I think sort of inevitably in that all the infrastructure of globalization that makes this possible is likely to grow. Part of that's air travel. Part of it's the ability to move currency around the world. Part of it's the internet that you can, look up doctors on other parts of the world and make appointments, and you can move MRIs or electronic medical records as an email attachment. A lot of things that just physically weren't possible 15, 20 years ago that make this work. And that's going to grow. And I think the next step will be, do governments and private and public insurers try to develop a system that facilitates this? This is still an area where almost all the risk falls on the patient. And so I think for it to grow into a large part of how people take in medicine, in the same way that, to some degree, that traveling abroad for school has become a significant part of global education. Governments have to sort of step in and set some rules and expectations about what people get when they cross borders for care.
Sasha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sasha Eisenberg is a journalist. He's a contributor for Bloomberg Politics, and his new book is Outpatients: The Astonishing New World of Medical Tourism. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and maybe you are not ready to travel for dental implants just yet. So how about some science, history, destination travel? Does that exist yet? I don't know, but I'm going to make a case for it. Let's head to a place that's very special to science and to radio and to me personally. Karlsruhe, Germany. It happens to be my hometown. And when I was there in June, I decided to visit the Karlsruhe Institute for Technology, because this is the place where Heinrich Hertz proved the existence of radio waves in the 1880s. It was a beautiful but brutally hot summer day, and my guide said we should meet right by the Hertz Memorial. It's a big stone sculpture of the famous physicist's head.
Yeah, guten Tag, ich bin die Maiken. Guten Tag. Ja, das bin ich. Hallo.
Danke, dass Sie. Volker Krebs used to teach engineering at this university. He's retired from that job now, but he heads the Heinrich Hertz Association, which is keeping the scientist's legacy alive. Hertz came to Karlsruhe in 1885, and he used his time here to build on the work of the Scottish physicist James Maxwell.
And Maxwell was the ingenious professor who was able to formulate the laws of propagation of electromagnetic waves in the famous Maxwell equations.
130 years ago, everything known about electromagnetic waves was theory. It was all on paper. And there were two competing ideas regarding how quickly these waves traveled. One camp argued that electric and magnetic forces were transmitted immediately from one point to another. So according to this theory, if you picked up a magnet and waved it around, that would instantly affect all the other charges in the room with no time delay. Maxwell's theory, on the other hand, predicted that electromagnetic waves propagated through space at the speed of light. Hertz wanted to find out which theory was right, and he did all of that work in an old stone building really close to the memorial where I met up with Volker Krebs. So he worked in this building, right?
Yeah.
It was warm inside the building, too, and we had to climb up a few flights of stairs to get to a large lecture room. We were both a little bit winded.
This is an original building, the laboratory where Heinrich Hertz did this experiment.
On one side of a long table, he had an oscillator generating electrical currents and a spark, or ignition. A few yards away, he set up a receiver or antenna made from copper wire that he bent into a circle. At the ends of the circle were small knobs separated by a tiny gap. It kind of looks like a big version of the rings people use to pierce their belly buttons. So Hertz wanted to test if the sparks generated by the oscillator would travel to the antenna and create a spark there in that tiny gap.
Yes, and when ignition takes place here, Hertz noticed in this antenna that here you find ignition 2. That is a hundredth of the millimeter only, and so you cannot see it very clear. So he had to darken the room, and then
this whole room, right?
This whole room, yes. And then he had a little microscope to notice whether there was ignition or not.
And it worked. The spark on the one side generates an electromagnetic wave, which travels through the room to the antenna, and a quick spark is seen when the generated voltage is high enough. Hertz was the first to detect this spark in the antenna. At the end of 1888, he wrote a famous paper demonstrating that Maxwell was right. Electromagnetic waves aren't infinitely fast, but instead they travel at the speed of light.
This paper was called Strahlen elektrischer Kraft.
That translates to rays of electrical force. And with that, Hertz was pretty much done with this topic. He wasn't interested in what could happen next. He's quoted saying that he didn't think these waves would have any practical applications. He went on to teach in Bonn and started working on other issues.
He was interested in mechanics. That is quite another subject.
He died in 1894 from an infection. He didn't live to see the unit of frequency named after him. That happened in 1930, or to see how his discovery changed every aspect of communication. Every time we turn on a radio or talk on our cell phones, we have Hertz to thank. Volker Krebs of the Heinrich Hertz Association was our tour guide. Special thanks to Atish Bhatia at Princeton for reviewing my rather shaky physics for this story. I can create some radio waves, but explaining how they travel is a whole other story. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Joel Wolfram is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, our associate producer. Joel Patterson is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, we'll talk about a very important convention in Philadelphia.
We need one another.
No, not that convention. We're talking about a huge gathering 40 years ago that led to a really important scientific discovery around a mysterious illness.
He came home and went to bed that night and never got out of bed.
Someone said there's some sort of an outbreak going on.
We didn't know the agent.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.